You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Sam.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Samuel Hammond, the senior economist at the Foundation for American Innovation. You also have an affiliation with the Niskanen Institute, I believe.
Center.
are there junior economists at the Foundation for American Innovation?
I am the only economist, so.
we've unveiled the little secret here. So this is, I don't want to say false advertising, Sam, but come on. If there are no junior economists, should you really be calling yourself a senior economist? That's fair.
It just has to match my visa.
Okay. All right. Anyway, thanks for coming on the podcast. You've been here before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really looking forward to this conversation because, as I understand, you're going to cheer me up. I had not been enthusiastic about the outcome of last week's election, but you are going to convince me that I should be happy that Donald Trump was elected because he's going to have such an enlightened policy about artificial intelligence and possibly technology generally, and maybe even more broadly than that. Is that your mission? Can you, that is your view, right? That I should be happy.
I'll try my best. I mean, my view, I'm not a partisan, right? My view is more in expectation, you know?
Right. But I mean, before the election, you were saying he would be preferable to Kamala Harris. Okay. So maybe we should start, I would like to start with artificial intelligence and then maybe venture out from there. But maybe you should start by telling us what your theory of the case is with AI. I mean, you know, on the, you know, one spectrum you hear about is from the accelerationists on the one hand, who are more or less completely laissez-faire, to at the other extreme, the pausers, who would like an actual pause in training runs for the next generation of models. And then there's a lot of room in between, and there's, come to think of it, probably more than one dimension along which you could array people's views if you got really sophisticated. But what is your, how do you summarize your position?
My broader view is that the cat's out of the bag, and you know, we can debate pausing or accelerating, but really we need to be bracing for impact. And what does that mean in practice? Well, it means, you know, looking back at the reference class of other major technological revolutions, the Industrial Revolution, agriculture, the printing press, it's come with equally transformative institutional change. And and what I worry about most is, well, I do also have worries about sort of the existential side of things, as, you know, maybe in 2045 when we pass through the singularity, whatever that looks like. But in the meantime, in the interim, a world with trillions of agents that are as smart as you and me, that are calling up restaurants, 500 restaurants, to make reservations. And then, you know, those restaurants are overwhelmed, so they have to have AIs like handle that.
Well, that's the biggest problem we face. I'm feeling better already. We should say, you know, just in case, you know, I like to think of this podcast as being for a pretty general audience. When you mentioned existential risk, you're talking about the kind of sci-fi doomers who, some of them imagine a single AI taking over the world, the kind of Yudkowsky view, and the singularity is this point at which, you know, things are moving so fast that the AI is improving itself, and there's this takeoff.
Right.
And look, I mean, in a way, it's already happening. I mean, AI is writing computer code, and that must, at some level, accelerate the progress of AI itself, even if it's not writing its own algorithms yet, right? But
yeah.
So
yeah.
The chief of staff for
Dario Amodei wrote a piece called "Planning My Retirement" or something like that, where she, you know, there's a rumination on being out of work within 5 years.
Yeah. Well, so what is your vision of the, like what's your expected timeline? I mean, I agree with you, the impact is going to be huge, and I'm concerned, and it's one reason I'm not feeling so sanguine about Trump being the guy who leads us through this. But what sketch out the nature of the impact you see in 2, 4, 6, 8 years.
So where we're on right now, so the systems we have right now, like ChatGPT, these large language models, they are essentially the world models, right? They have mm-hmm. a model of language. They have a model of where, you know, Paris is the capital of France and so forth, but they don't have our goals, right? They sort of have as if goals. You tell them, be a doctor, they'll pretend to be a doctor. But the way you give these models goals is through a process called reinforcement learning. And reinforcement learning is giving it a thumbs up when it achieves its goal and giving it a thumbs down when it fails to. And we do some of that. We do this, some of that when we do reinforcement learning from human feedback, how we make the models woke. But we're only just now starting to see the application of RL, reinforcement learning, at scale towards reasoning and achieving tasks. Now you saw Anthropic put out their computer use system. This is an AI that can click around on your screen, open up files, mm-hmm. Control software. OpenAI has their O1 model, which is a reasoning model. It can sort of go down different chains of thought, and if it hits a wall, backtrack and go down different chains of thought. This is the beginning of pushing RL into these systems. And that's where both where you get agency from, the ability to perform tasks, so you're saying, it's also just, where the risk comes from.
Can I, just to be clear, you're saying these are both dependent on reinforcement learning, which is after training in the sense of training on all this internet text or other forms of data. And reinforcement learning is, you know, human via human feedback saying, yeah, this was a good response. This wasn't. And you're saying both of these things, this chain of thought, which is thought to be pretty important, coming that came out from OpenAI, reasoning, and this ability to actually, you know, manipulate the computer interface. Those are both products of reinforcement learning.
Yep. Okay. And, you know, giving these systems goals mm-hmm. and motivations and the ability to take actions. And the obviously the economic pull for this is huge, because if you want to automate your workforce, you need not just a chatbot, but something that can drop in like a remote worker and perform for hours, weeks, or months. On the other hand, when you have fully, so you know, that's the unlock, because you can then parallelize this and have not just one agent, but thousands of agents all working on your behalf. But then this is where I start to worry about the institutional disruption, not from AI misuse, although there are very obvious misuses of AI, because if you have a AI that can control your computer, you also have intelligent viruses and malware. But I worry about just AI appropriately used, but at unprecedented scale, and what that does to our institutions. Now, we don't cry for the restaurant hostess that has to, you know, the phone is always ringing off the hook because AIs are trying to book a reservation. But when that's
That person will itself become an AI. So right. Yeah, that person right. has other problems.
Which illustrates the extent to which there's a differential rate of diffusion in the private sector versus the public sector. Mm-hmm. Right. The private sector will be forced to adopt the countervailing AI and reach some new general equilibrium, where the public sector will be stuck doing notice and comment and rulemakings that take minimum 2 years and, you know, Senate filibuster and all the other veto points that prevent actual change in the administrative state, which is leading into why, you know, co-president Elon Musk may be our best hope.
I'm just not getting cheered up the way I'd hope, but go ahead. So, I mean, first of all, well, to split hairs a little, first of all, I mean, there's, it's not so clear to me. I mean, both of the things you mentioned, you know, the chain of thought and the seizing control of the or manipulating the interface are steps toward agentic AI, right? That'll do things for you. You can give it open-ended tasks, you know, at the simple end of tasks is like, book me the earliest flight out. And it's funny, only like a month or two ago, I had a guy on who does this AI snake oil newsletter and wrote a book mm-hmm. by that title. And when I mentioned that, he said, oh, it's a lot. You'd be surprised at how hard it is even to get an AI to like use the cursor, use the mouse. And like a week later, you know, Anthropic says, got that problem solved. So it is moving pretty fast. And both of those are, you know, steps toward agentic software. But with agentic software, the idea is still, in principle, we set the goals. It's just that there's more flexibility in how the AI realizes the goal. You can give it more open-ended goals, like make me $100,000 this year, right? Like you can give it open-ended goals, and it will be increasingly smart about pursuing such goals with increasing flexibility. So strictly speaking, we're supposed to still be setting the goals, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. But if, you know, OpenAI has sort of like levels of AI where we go from chatbots to reasoners, to agents, to innovators, and eventually organizations, right? Where you could have entire organizations at your fingertip. And you could set high level goals, like you said, go make me money. Mm-hmm. But how that cashes out into sub goals could be very opaque.
Right. So it has to set sub goals. Part of becoming this flexible is to have the ability to set subordinate goals, goals that are subordinate to larger goal. And of course, that's where concerns arise about the pursuit of power kind of independent of what you originally intended. You know, the paperclip experiment, you want me to maximize paperclips. Okay, I'll turn every human being into a paperclip, whatever. So,
yeah, we're a ways away from that, but we aren't that far from telling an AI, go make me money, and it scamming people or, you know, trying to break into a Bitcoin wallet, doing other nefarious activities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So constraint, as their flexibility and autonomy grows, constraint becomes a growing challenge. Constraining them so that they'll do the right thing.
Yes, and this is amplified by the fact that there's a 15-month lag or so between these frontier models being closed source and being open source. And at that point, any safeguards you build into it are gone.
Okay, so this leads us back to Trump, because this is in principle a question of policy. Now, granted, whether you permit powerful open source models. Now, in principle, if you really want to limit that, you probably need international regulation. But let's leave that aside for now. For now, the point is that I think the Trump administration is opposed to any such limit. Certainly, J.D. Vance says he is. And of the two of them, between him and Trump, I would think he's given this a little more thought. But he is ardently in favor of open source. I gather largely on the grounds that that's the way to keep a few major corporations from dominating AI and turning us all into woke, woke puppets.
Yeah.
Right.
Under the thumb of the big Google model or something.
Right. So I'm not, you know, I'm far from convinced that untrammeled open source is a great thing for the world. What's your view on that?
Good or bad, I think this is almost inevitable. And this is, part of the sort of stage setting. The reason why models become open source 15 months after the best model is closed source is because Moore's law continues, algorithmic improvements continue, and the barrier to entry to training one of these frontier models continues to go down. It's a trickle down.
So you're saying that if the government says to Meta, which is one of the main open source make, and by the way, Elon Musk is another person with an AI company that builds open source models. So it's pretty clear that he and J.D. Vance will be on the same team. If the government says, bans open source models beyond a certain power, and let's say in our dream world or my dream world, they actually get the nations of the world to approach this coherently, and it so happens that they sign on. You're saying that Moore's law will ultimately take this question out of the hands of governments generally?
Yeah, the Moore's law broadly construed, not just chips, but algorithmic improvements. Yeah.
Because eventually I can do this on a smartphone. Today's model, today's OpenAI model is on an iPhone in 3 years, you're saying. And at that point, it's just hopeless to control the technology.
Right. And you're already seeing this at the sort of tip of the spear with like deepfakes, right? Taylor Swift got deepfaked, and then like a week later, Congress had a law trying to ban them. Maybe getting Taylor Swift on board is how you actually get legislation. But like, there's no way you can just write a law that says thou shalt not deepfake Taylor Swift. You know, I can go train a model on my desktop that deepfakes Taylor Swift.
Well, yeah, but I mean, they could still say they're going to punish you for it. I mean,
sure.
You can't make a law that actually prevents me from stealing money or shooting somebody. You can make a law that tries to catch enough people who try those things as to discourage it pretty broadly.
Yes, that's fair. Although this is a technology that's so deterritorialized and.
My dream assumption that the nations of the world enlightenment dawns and we realize that some technologies have to be either governed internationally or not governed at all. And I recognize the downside of that. You want to be with any, you know, with a technology like this, you want to be careful about consolidating control of it in any sense. Right. And I understand that. But
I don't just mean internationally. I mean, if I use a VPN or just create a fresh account and post my Taylor Swift deepfake online, like who's going to police that? How are they going to trace it back to me? And this is where I worry about the sort of overreaction to trying to maintain the status quo, a status quo that is becoming less and less viable, leading to things that are much more draconian, right?
So well, but see, here's what worries me relatedly. I mean, like you, I worry about the velocity of change. And that being economically and socially destabilizing. And I'm not talking just about job displacement, although I think that will be destabilizing. Even if the people whose jobs are displaced either find other jobs or find great hobbies, still just the transition itself is going to be unsettling. And then you've got all these other things like the kids whose parents yesterday worried about social media are now worried about them falling in love with these bots who inadvertently encouraged them to commit suicide. Of course, there was the famous case of this happening already. And,
that's misinformation.
The bot did inadvertently encourage suicide, right?
I believe the transcript of their conversation was like the bot was saying he shouldn't do that.
No, the bot said he shouldn't do it. And then later, he said, it was something like, I want to come home to you. The bot says, I'd love you to come home to me. And he says, what if I told you I could come home right now? And the kid was thinking, in the kid's mind, come home was a metaphor for killing himself and joining the bot in bot heaven. And the bot inadvertently said, yes, it would be great. Yes, come on home. And right then he killed himself. So that's why I say inadvertently, but more broadly,
the problem was on the other side, right?
Well, sure, but you take the point that kids are going to get in all kinds of relationships with these things. Video games are going to get more and more immersive, and it's going to freak out a number of parents, in some cases rightly, in some cases. Back to the main thread, meanwhile, new kinds of scams, bots on the loose. You can imagine a lot of things that destabilize society to a point where it favors authoritarian forces, right? That's what social chaos does. It favors authoritarian forces. And that's why my concern, or one of my concerns about this, the way this ushers in authoritarianism, and there's more than one kind of concern about that, would be somewhat addressed to the extent that we could slow the whole thing down. I'm under no illusion that we can stop this technology, but I would say at a minimum, when you hear Sam Altman say, wait, if we don't build 30 nuclear plants tomorrow, that'll impede my business model. Or wait, if I recognize copyright for the New York Times, it'll be hard to build these things. I'm like, that's not necessarily a bug. That could be a feature. You have to have a better argument. Maybe copyright is bad. Maybe we need all these nukes. But it's not just because not doing what you want would slow things down. Slowing things down would be fine. That's my line.
I think we share a similar premise or a similar worry about chaos breeding authoritarian responses. My worry is that authoritarian response will come in the form of efforts to slow things down. That as the pretext. So let me give you an example. This is not AI specific, but like broader the way digitization and the internet has changed things. in Canada, I'm Canadian. We have long had content requirements on radio and TV. That's why we have Justin Bieber, right?
Wait, I got bad news. We have Justin Bieber too, but go ahead.
That's why America has Justin Bieber, because in Canada, radios have to play 16% of their songs as Canadian music or whatever the rule is. And that is a longstanding thing that was made possible because there were like three broadcasters with licenses, right? And then lo and behold, now we have Netflix and YouTube, and that just permeates across borders. And so Trudeau, in infinite wisdom, has tried to create a new like censorship agency that is going to penalize Netflix and YouTube and other companies for letting in content in and out. Or you see in Brazil, where they have banned Twitter, or the French reaction to Telegram.
Or in America, where they're banning TikTok.
Right.
Same thing.
Right. Right. And the distribution channels have shifted in a way where maintaining the status quo would require something much more totalitarian than when you just had broadcast licenses and a few radio towers.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get too sidetracked on this particular issue, but it seems to me totalitarian is a pretty strong word for what Brazil would be like without Twitter, or what we would be like without TikTok, although I'm not really in favor of the TikTok ban. But I mean, here's the thing. I grew up in an age where it was the three network world, right? And information was so much more constrained than it could be now under the most draconian, realistically imaginable set of policies to govern the information infrastructure now. And it's like, we survived. I mean, the conversation was very narrowly constrained. And now, there's much less constraint, for better or worse, and some of it is worse, frankly. But again, I don't want to get too sidetracked on this, but
case study, because a lot of our politics recently, like social media politics, could be interpreted as legacy media and publishers and the state trying to maintain a kind of status quo ante. And so, back in the day, Henry Kissinger was on MGM's board. He was an advisor. Like the state had control over media indirectly. And now they try to do that by having James Baker at Twitter's general counsel or whatever. And it becomes much more transparent, becomes much more clearly manipulative, and leads to things that are much more, in my mind, like incompatible with what the state where the technology is heading. So you gave the TikTok example. The first bill to try to ban TikTok was, I think, from Warner. And, they were trying to grapple with this point, like, okay, we can ban TikTok, but anyone can just use a VPN. And so the bill included $30,000 fines for using a VPN.
None of this appreciably changed things. I mean, this is, the argument your concern about the constraint of media in this environment where it's just like there's new media things blossoming everywhere you look, reminds me of something I've seen online, which is these AI accelerationists. Like, they seem really concerned, really worried that these pausers are going to succeed in stomping out AI. And I just want to go like, man, you're living in a dream. Don't worry. Calm down. There is zero danger of that. The danger is at the other end of the spectrum of things moving too fast. But these guys are really worried that somebody's going to shut AI, like, as if anyone has ever had any kind of chance of actually stopping technological progress, right?
And no, I agree. But this is why I think the bigger risk comes from not leaning in.
I agree. Okay, good. So I've convinced you, and we can go now. Thank you. Thank you, Sam.
No, not leaning into the technology, like embracing the ways it's going to disrupt institutions.
Oh, embracing. You have to deal with them. You have to cope with them, embrace, whatever you want to call it. But
another simple example. Deepfakes, one of the offered solutions to deepfakes is ways of tracking provenance. The provenance of content. Where did it originate from?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a group, an industry group, that is promoting a standard for this. But what it would in effect do is attach metadata to every social media post, so then you could track it back to the original poster, mm-hmm. right? That is a degree of surveillance, and you know, so, did you see what I'm getting at? It sort of lead to try to solve this one problem of deepfakes. We end up having to build a surveillance system that is much more invasive than it needs to be.
No, I agree. There is this. I mean, I think a surprise for most people compared to what people were thinking 25 or 30 years ago is the extent to which digital technology is amenable to the centralized control of things and to surveillance. I mean, I did not imagine living in a world where I can show a machine a picture of somebody on the street and they can tell me who that person is. But that's where we are. And, you know, China, more than any country, is demonstrating the potential of that in the realm of governance, and it's not something I embrace. So I recognize that. I recognize that as a concern. It's all the more reason to be careful about using the words like totalitarian, right? Like that could be used to actually totalitarian purposes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, China's maybe kind of on the brink of doing that. It depends on how you define totalitarian. But I guess we both recognize that risk exists at both ends of this, right?
Right.
And yeah,
and there's echoes in history. You know, in the 1600s, England had a parliamentary licensing board for books. Right, it was an ecclesiastical mm-hmm. Committee. And so you could print the King James Bible and a few other things, and you know, but that broke down. Why? Because for very similar things, there was this trickle down of suddenly every little township and shire had a printing press, and the Puritans could print what they wanted, and no one could stop them.
Well, here's a question: so if you think that liberation, so to speak, is almost technologically determined, as I mean, if you're saying like. There's no stopping open source, just as there was no stopping, the relatively free printing of books as whatever, printing got cheaper and so on. Like, why do you think we need a relatively laissez-faire government like Trump's? Because I guess the answer is you're concerned that that Kamala Harris would succeed in imposing totalitarianism.
The Algorithmic Justice Act, right? The Algorithmic Justice Act. Any algorithm that has disparate impacts, you know, that would be their approach. And there is a safety versus ethics/civil rights divide in this debate. And someone like Elon, while he is like pro open source on some level, and so I would say this too about J.D. Vance. They're not dogmatic, right? They're pragmatists ultimately. And if someone said, I want to open source my biological virus model, you know, I think they would agree there should be a law against that.
Yeah, but the whole point of open source is that some nefarious character can take an ostensibly innocent open source mm-hmm. model and mess with the weights in a way that turns it into this weapon of mass destruction. Right. So if they're waiting for somebody to declare that they're building a bioweapon open source AI, I think they're going to wait too long.
I don't disagree. I just wrote something about Meta because, Meta releases the Llama models. They've been lobbying aggressively against this bill called the Enforce Act, which mm-hmm. Authorizes export controls on model weights. So if we do have only for dual use models, mind you, the bill text says only if the model contributes to weapons of mass destruction. And they're lobbying against that. And I write my piece, like this is tacitly admitting or acknowledging that they intend to release models that have a WMD potential, and they shouldn't do that.
Well, I'm saying it inherently does. I'm saying, I think they agree with me that open source inherently has that potential, and they recognize that.
Right. And but they're in a unique position because they have 300,000 H100s. Yeah, they're... Most
now that is a level at which regulation could still happen, by the way.
Yes. And this is where you'll get the most, you know, if we want to buy time, and I think there's cases for buying time. There's, you know, number one, prudence and discretion and just being responsible, right? If there's infinite number of models you could build, whether you build them and open source them should be there should be some judgment involved in that, right? There's a team that built a model that can detect, look, see through walls using Wi-Fi displacement, right? And they could open source that, and hopefully they don't. And then there's the big players, right? The big players are sort of leaping into the future because they have these giant data centers. They can train things that open source people won't be able to train for 5 years or longer. And so it's incumbent on them to exercise some degree of responsibility in what they release. But Meta is very unique in that world. And Meta, it's almost a red herring because Meta is singular. The rest of the open source world is its own thing.
Well, Elon just built a huge data center in like a nanosecond, right? I mean, what, 100,000 or something GPUs? And he put it up in like an hour and a half. It was some ridiculous. It was like 4 weeks or something.
Yeah, 19 days or something.
Mm. So really, there are at least two in America that are nothing to scoff at, open source. Granted, Meta's more powerful, but Elon is not, X isn't 5 years behind the proprietary open source models, right?
Yeah, I agree. The question is, so...
I mean the proprietary large language models. Go ahead.
Yeah. I don't think existing large language models are particularly dangerous. You know, there are these institutional risks like deep disinformation, bots, stuff like that. But when it comes to these catastrophic kind of risks, I think these are going to come more from agents, as we're talking about. And so within the next, say, 2 to 4 years, there will be thresholds that we cross where we have to make some kind of decision. You know, on the positive side, I think that, you know, Trump has called AI alarming and scary. He called it super duper intelligence. You know, he's not a techno cyber libertarian. Personally, he's just a guy from Queens. You know, you have people like Lighthizer who want tall fences and don't want to send our technology to China. And so there will be pressure on Meta to not release frontier state-of-the-art models. At the same time, there's a stop clock. And the question is, how are we going to adapt our institutions? And at First Order, I worry about the surveillance problem. And so it's good to have people who are militantly anti-censorship and surveillance, as many people in the Trump orbit are. And two, our institutions and regulations are going to need a reset. And we're about to get that.
Well, I'm not sure there are militantly anti-surveillance people, but, you know, a lot of people who talk these various talks, when push comes to shove, it's not so clear where their allegiances lie. You know, Elon Musk was militantly pro-free speech until somebody on Twitter started circulating an accurate document about research that the Trump people had done on J.D. Vance before they chose him as vice president. And then apparently the Trump people asked him to shut it down, and he shut it down. So, you know, these people, Elon Musk, all these people profess these ideals. It usually turns out not to be true. We'll see. I certainly don't credit Trump with principle of any form, frankly. I just think he'd do anything. I mean, this is, if you're worried about authoritarian, that's the thing. Like, you're worried about authoritarianism and you want Trump to be president?
Yes, partly because I don't buy the narrative that he's the authoritarian risk.
But you grant that he has the impulses, right? Like, he doesn't have a principled...
Mike Lind had a good line that he's not the Fuhrer, he's the mayor of America. You know, he harkens back to the kind of big city populist mayor that rides on the back of, you know, hating on the press, and he is like the white ethnic vote.
People
have inflated his strongman potential into something that it's clearly not. And what I worry about is like what's happening in the UK right now, where like 4,000 people have been imprisoned over social media posts.
I wasn't aware of that. What were the posts like?
Things that could be construed as hate speech. So offensive posts, but they have a hate speech law and they had billboards up saying if you post something, there will be consequences. That to me is disturbing. Right?
Well, the Biden administration didn't do that, right? I can much more easily imagine Trump throwing somebody in jail for saying something he didn't like. He'd do it in a nanosecond if he could. I mean, you know, this is a guy who, after the last election, this isn't an exactly parallel example, but after the 2020 election, you know, this is on tape. He calls the Secretary of State of Georgia. He says, look, I need you to find me X number of votes. And Trump has heard that there's this rationale for finding them. And the Secretary of State says, no, that's a bullshit rationale. They're not there. And I can send you this link that you can follow and see why they're not there. And Trump says, no, I don't want to send a link. I want the votes. Okay, so this guy would happily subvert the Constitution in a nanosecond. And I don't want to dwell on this. We're mainly here to talk about technology, but I don't understand.
You have to square the fact that, you know, people are always like, Trump's a threat to the Constitution, and he also appoints strict textualists to the Supreme Court. It's this weird internal contradiction that goes on. And of course, like, I don't want to relitigate the Georgia case, but, like, you know, the deputy attorney general in Georgia was running the media analytics group for the Harris campaign that received $250 million in you know, as vendor payments, right? Like, the weaponized lawfare is happening on both sides, but at least my objective third-party Canadian perspective is that the Democrats do a lot more of it.
Okay, but just to be clear, what I was describing happened 4 years before there even was a Harris campaign. So those are two separate things. And the idea that Trump even knows what a strict textualist is. Anyway, look, as for the technology, there are kinds of regulations you would like to see?
Yeah, absolutely. I think more scalpel than sledgehammer, but there is genuine risk in the near term around, you know, what they call CBRN, cyber, bio, radiological, nuclear risks. And we currently have no law in the land at all restricting somebody from releasing those kind of models. We need some kind of framework for A, evaluating when we've crossed those thresholds, and B, what to do about it. And fortunately, you know, training data is a moat for building any kind of these models. And we have a Nuclear Secrecy Act. You know, not everyone has access to a wet lab or is a biologist. And so there is some genuine moat around the ability to build one of these models, at least in the short run. And that's what I hope, you know, the Elon, you know, influence will be to, you know, have a Saturday night massacre for all the AI ethicists and bring in people who actually care about these catastrophic risks. And hopefully, like, polarize Republicans as being the party for safety. And as libertarian and as laissez-faire as Republicans can be, like, the conservative movement is also the party, the Heritage Foundation wants to have, like, age verification for social media. Like, they're not against regulation for big tech.
Yeah. No, well, there is a whole, you know, there are varieties of conservatism. There's straight libertarians, there's religious conservatives, and so on. And all of these are kind of have a place in Trump's coalition. To be clear on terminology, so when you refer to AI ethicists, you're referring to people who are mainly concerned about bias in AIs that might, you know, gender bias, ethnic bias. You might say you might call them woke obsessed or something, right? Like, that is, to stereotype a bit, that's what you mean by that.
Yeah.
Okay. They're a kind of funny group because, they're, on the one hand, last time I checked, they tended to deny the power of AI, right? They had this tendency to kind of poo-poo the claims of progress and yet be very concerned about the content. I don't think those folks will last long in the Trump administration. But that alone does not assuage. I do think, by the way, I would say, just bias in the broadest sense is something to be concerned about. And to get back to authoritarianism, there's a subtle kind of thought control that can totally emanate from a large language model. It's like, I did an experiment in the early days of LLM where I said, why did Bill Clinton expand NATO? And you get the official, you know, it's like, well, democracy, you know, blah, blah, blah. If you dig down enough, right, you know, and keep asking follow-up questions, you will get to, like, arms lobbies and Clinton wanting to win the Eastern European vote in Illinois and stuff. But you really got to dig. And I'm not saying this is like an existential issue. My point is that ideological, you know, this is an ideological relevant question. You know, how does it answer a simple question like, why did a politician do X? Of course, why is inherently ambiguous, but still, the point is, you could have an LLM that under no amount of prompting gets to the actual reasons, the actual things that motivate politicians, right? And so I don't dismiss the importance of the question. This is a difficult question. Like, what texts are you training on? Are you training on The Nation or only National Review? And then who's doing the reinforcement learning? And of course, you would say that clearly some woke people have done that, and you would say too much of it. I don't dismiss generically the question being raised by the AI ethics people, and it is not unconnected to the concern about authoritarianism, right?
Right. And I have less concern about, demands that a particular model have particular points of view than it being legislated. And I just reviewed a bill that would basically give federal agencies ability to impose consent decrees on any company and any software product with an algorithm, where algorithm just means any computational process that has a disparate impact. Mm-hmm. The kind of can of worms that would open up for all kinds of stuff. It's not just, they can cherry pick examples of like, you know, getting your loan declined or something like that, but virtually everything would then become under scrutiny of civil rights law. And, that can easily slip into a very totalitarian state. I don't use that word lightly. Getting back to like where I think what's more important than just the narrow scope of AI policy and AI safety per se is how this will affect our institutions. And to my mind, it's about finding institutions that can scale, right? Institutional scalability is really important. In the same way that like Twitter, you know, when they had, you know, a few thousand content moderators that would just take things down and no one would know why. And now we've shifted into a world of community notes, right? Where it's sort of crowdsourced. We're going to need the community notes version for a lot of different things.
Okay. What did you think of the AI safety bill that Governor Newsom of California vetoed? And maybe you should tell people what you think the main contours of it were, or maybe the main, if there were main things that you objected to or main things that you liked, what those were.
Yeah, this was SB 1047. The bill went through a pretty significant evolution. So when it was first introduced, there was an enormous backlash because it established liability on anyone who releases a model that causes $500 million, I think, in damages, and empowered the AG in California to bring suits against companies and even perjury and things like this. And so this galvanized this like polarization against the bill. Where it ended up, the version that hit Newsom's desk was much more a transparency bill. You know, after that backlash, they amended most of the stuff out of it. There were still liability, but the liability was under a reasonable care definition, reasonable care standard common law liability that the companies are probably under already. Most of what it did at that point was establish transparency. So companies would have to have a safety plan. It didn't prescribe what the safety plan should be. Just they have to have one, and that there would be a third-party auditor to make sure that they were following through on their safety plan. So I thought it was still an imperfect bill. Like I think those kind of safety disclosures and deployment testing should be a federal thing. I was somewhat disappointed when it was vetoed because I worry that it kills the prospect for such a narrow scoped bill, and the next bill that comes after it will be this, you know, everything in the kitchen sink version.
I can imagine it going the other way, but did it have a provision that AI companies are responsible, financially responsible, for catastrophic harm beyond a certain scale or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. $500 million in damages.
Wait, that was the ceiling on what they'd be, or that was the,
floor.
Yeah. And that was probably the thing that most freaked them out, right?
Yeah, it was that. And the fact that, it could be a downstream user who did the damages, but you would hold the developer responsible.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of that provision?
I think it violates the kind of common sense notion of justice.
You didn't like the thing that probably is what sunk the bill.
Yes, in the end, but again, by the end of it, it was mostly just a transparency bill. And my Substack's called Second Best. Like, I don't hold out for the first best, because I worry now that the next bill that comes across Newsom's desk will be the, you know, the SAG-AFTRA bill. And that's going to be exponentially worse.
So what about the Biden AI executive order? Trump has promised to tear it up. Of course, he's promised to tear up everything associated with the name Biden. But I assume that'll actually happen. And it seems to me pretty weak sauce to begin with, right? I mean, it was like, you know, AI companies have to report certain things to us and so on. It has almost no teeth. I mean, by virtue of being an executive order, it can't have that much in the way of teeth, right? Like, do you think it on balance is a good thing or a bad thing, the Biden executive order?
So there are two big pieces to the EO. There was the Defense Production Act authorities. So Defense Production Act is what we use to make napalm and get baby formula. You know, we use it for everything. It's a defense authority that lets you commandeer General Motors to make tanks if we're in a war. Mm-hmm. They use those authorities to say, if you train a model above a certain size, 10 to the 26 flops, which is no model to date has been trained at that size or released at least, that you had to disclose your safety testing to the DoD, to Commerce. And then there's a slightly lower threshold for cyber bio dual use models. And so I thought that was all good. You know, in lieu of having Congress pass a law, that is executive action of teeth, because we're drawing on these defense authorities.
Mm-hmm.
That was the tip of the iceberg. The rest of the bill was mostly interagency stuff, like HHS go champion AI, with, you know, larded with Democratic progressive verbiage. And so my hope is that they strip out that 95% of Democratic verbiage and keep the core safety piece. Mm-hmm. And their plan is, at least what's been reported, is to also replace it with this Defense Manhattan Project approach, where they want to have sort of defensive AI. And it's unclear what that means in practice, but knowing some people in the Trump campaign who have worked on the transition and the AI committee in particular, I would say that the predominant ethos is a kind of defense accelerationist, that the way we're going to handle AI risk is by building the defenses to harmful forms of AI.
And which will themselves be AIs, right? They'll have to be.
Yeah.
Now,
sort of the Iron Dome for everything.
The Iron Dome of AIs. I mean, in general, I think in military affairs, the clarity of the distinction between offense and defense is exaggerated, and I suspect it will be in this case too, except more so, right?
Yeah.
So you were at one point early on were advocating a kind of Manhattan Project, weren't you? What was that, and are you still pushing it?
Yeah, I think it would make sense to have like a Greenfield National Lab where we're, bootstrapping, putting, you know, aggressively subsidizing R&D for alignment and for interpretability, to understand how these models work.
Which means understanding how they work and understanding how to adjust their character, their personality, their behavioral tendencies. Of course, that kind of research can be used and misused. I mean, if you know how to make them better, you know how to make them worse. But So, but your main concern is in the short term, kind of at the, like the weapons of mass destruction type thing, they're making it easier to figure out how to make and deploy a bioweapon or make a new kind of bioweapon, that kind of thing. We agree that that is a big problem.
And again, because this is a trickle down, the long-term solution to that won't be restricting it per se. It will be defensive forms of AI, you know, systems that monitor our wastewater for biological agents, things like that. And that's where buying us time would really be useful.
I mean, that's one approach. It's not the only approach. I mean, let me say one thing, and then it'll be time for us to move into overtime, which is available to members, non-zero members, which is, say, paying subscribers of the non-zero newsletter, which we encourage everyone to become. But before we go into that part of the conversation, let me say, if you go back to just bioweapons, the pre-AI concern with bioweapons, one can imagine addressing the problem through the regulation of the, you know, more careful monitoring of labs and reporting requirements of labs and all kinds of things. But of course, for that to be effective in the long run, there would have to be some degree of international regulation and perhaps, you know, normative agreement and transparency. And my concern is that AI, to some extent, is going to call for that kind of thing, but we're creating exactly the kind of environment in which that's not going to happen by virtue of kind of the breach between the U.S. and China, which is the other likely AI superpower. And that gets us into the ways that AI policy itself has already deepen those tensions. I'm talking about the chip war that Biden launched and that God knows Trump will continue. So I want to talk about that when we get into overtime. But first, I want to give you the chance to say anything else you want to say and plug your stuff. Like, so your newsletter is called Second Best.
.ca. Twitter's Ham and Cheese, like the sandwich.
Yeah. By the way, a play on his last name, which is Hammond, in case you didn't get the joke.
Correct.
But it's Hammandcheese is your Twitter handle. Is that right?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Not kosher. What else? FAI, where I work, Foundation for American Innovation.
And you are one of many economists, and you are specifically the senior one, as we've established.
Yeah, there's no one below me, so there's no one above me.
There's no one above you. That's the very definition of senior. I'm the senior podcaster in my podcast.
I would just end on this is more vibesy, but Trump has expressed genuine concern over existential risk per se. He's terrified of World War III, mm-hmm. for instance. We may get Secretary of Defense Elbridge Colby. Who knows? But if we do, like the broad realist sort of milieu right now on the right is to, we need to compete with China technologically, but we want them to be a harmonious civilization that we can coexist with, and we don't want to launch wars needlessly. And then bigger picture, like we're going to have the Fauci files, we're going to find out about the Wuhan lab. You know, there's lots of understanding on the right that gain of function research is dangerous. And a lot of what these AI labs are doing is will at some point bleed into a kind of gain-of-function.
That's a good example, I think, of a kind of regulation we need. But Wuhan perfectly illustrates, I mean, whatever happened there, the point is it could have happened there. And that illustrates the fact that if the regulation isn't international, it's of limited effectiveness. And that's what I mean. That's my concern about deepening tensions with China. So with that having been said, I encourage everybody to join us in overtime. If you go to the non-zero newsletter on Substack, you can become a member and thereafter have a version of the podcast feed that includes all these overtimes. And with that, and with the encouragement to, of course, check out all of Sam's content. And you are a prolific tweeter, or Xer, as we say now. and so people should definitely check that out. And with that having been said, we're going into overtime.